everyone. Welcome back to New Books in History. I'm your host, Peter Christian Agner. Today we're speaking with Sophia Lee about her new book, The Workplace Constitution, From the New Deal to the New Right. Sophia, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to do this.
I'm glad that you agreed. Why don't you begin by telling us about yourself and how you came to this project?
So I'm currently a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. I've been here for about 6 years. And I trained as a legal historian, so I have a JD and a PhD in history. And I came to this book, this is my first book, as a graduate student many years ago now. And I really came upon the topic doing research for a professor. So I had been assigned as sort of for a summer to spend my time kind of rooting around in the ways equal protection and race were thought to have something to do with each other in the mid-20th century, so the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I was looking at judicial opinions and also at legal academic articles to some extent popular sources, and just trying to understand how people's thinking about equal protection and race and changed over the course of that period. And one of the things that I was struck by was that there was so much more creative lawyering and thinking about how the Constitution might be used to address racial discrimination and where it might be used to address racial discrimination than I had been aware of. And this ranged everything from, for the legal people out there, Commerce Clause arguments having to do with public transportation, arguments about, the Constitution barring discrimination in housing, many spheres of life other than public schools, which is sort of the dominant narrative of the NAACP's legal campaign against segregation in public schools during this period. So it was really struck by the creativity of the lawyering. And for many of these, if you notice the kinds of places I was talking about, say, for instance, housing is something that we think of mostly as being, as being something that is happening in the private sector. So private people are selling houses, and who are they selling them to, as opposed to public schools, which are run by the government. And so what's striking about that is that people also traditionally, lawyers, think of the Constitution's rights-bearing provisions, the parts of the Constitution that give us some legal tools against racial discrimination, as being limited by what's called the state action doctrine, which is this legal rule that says that the Constitution only requires non-discrimination by the state and its agents, so not private individuals, which means I can discriminate against Peter all I want because we are just two private individuals. If I were the government, though, I would no longer be able to discriminate against him. That would be unconstitutional. So one of the things civil rights litigators were up against was not only an idea that segregation wasn't discrimination, but also an idea that whatever constitutional rights African Americans had, they didn't extend to their interactions with private actors, private sector actors like homeowners. So one of the things that I was really struck by in reading this history was how creative civil rights litigators were at trying to reach those supposedly private forms of discrimination and not just targeting the kind of government forms of discrimination like segregated schools. But in seeing this really creative lawyering, there was one thing that seemed to be missing, which seemed just sort of puzzling to me, which was the workplace. And I just didn't understand why, if there was so much creative litigating going on, and so many efforts to try to bring the Constitution into these private zones, supposedly private zones like the housing, why you wouldn't see that same kind of creativity going on in terms of trying to reach the workplace and discrimination in the workplace, especially given that workplace discrimination was one of the sort of major concerns that African Americans had in the sort of modern civil rights era, leading to things like the March on Washington movement and the efforts to try to get a Fair Employment Committee created under the federal by federal law. So I really came upon this topic by seeing an absence. And at first, I thought what I was going to be doing was telling a story about why there wasn't any effort to win constitutional rights in the workplace on the behalf of African-American workers. And that was really the little seed that grew over, you know, over the next 10 years into this book. And one of the first sort of big aha moments for me was figuring out that actually civil rights lawyers were trying to win constitutional rights against discrimination in the workplace. And it had all the hallmarks of creativity I had seen everywhere else. One of those was that they brought those claims primarily before administrative agencies and not in courts. And so one reason it seemed like it wasn't there was just that I wasn't going to see it very well if I was looking just in courts. Another was that what happened as these cases moved up, even the ones that were brought in court, as they moved up the chain of the appellate courts, by the time they got to the highest courts, courts had sort of sanitized them of their constitutional claims. So it also took sort of digging more at the trial level to find these claims. But that was really the seed. It was an effort to try to fill it, try to understand an absence, and lo and behold, it ended up revealing this very rich presence, both, it turned out, on the part of civil rights advocates and their labor allies, and I later found out on the part of conservatives who were also trying to bring the Constitution into the workplace during this period.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of historians who would have begun with that narrative. I mean, this book, interesting about your book is that, you know, it's sort of this received wisdom for a lot of folks that there isn't this sort of action at the workplace level, that the narrative you refer to about NAACP going after segregation in education, that's where the focus is. And whether because of the Cold War or some other factor, early civil rights groups aren't focusing on the workplace. And that's what makes this story so fascinating, among other things. And you know, the point about these administrative bodies that you write about, you have this line in the beginning where you describe it, you know, administrative bodies as an overlooked but omnipresent constitutional force in the modern American state. And I suppose a lot of Americans wouldn't quite think about the FCC or the NLRB in those terms. But for scholars, right, this is a really important fact because the administrative state grows tremendously after the New Deal. And it is a huge part of this story. Why don't we begin with some of the characters that you introduce here? You begin the introduction talking about a fellow named C.W. Rice, who you write did not know it, but set the stage for a 50-year struggle that has left Americans today with little or no constitutional protection in the workplace. Who was Rice, and what do you mean by that?
So C.W. Rice was, I guess in some ways you'd say who he was would depend on who you asked. He had worked his way up in the early 20th century to a position of leadership in Houston's African American community. He ran a sort of labor service, which essentially meant he worked as a liaison helping African Americans find jobs among the local employers, and he was a big proponent of independent Black unions. So he thought it was a good idea for Black workers to collectivize and to form unions, but he thought very strongly that they should do that in their own separate unions, not try to integrate into the mostly all white unions that were associated with the American Federation of Labor. And So what does that mean? So the reason I start with them is a puzzle, sort of a puzzle that sort of continues throughout the book, is because on one account, he was, sort of a practical, sort of realistic leader of Black labor who recognized that if African Americans were going to be a minority in all white unions, they were going to be discriminated against within the union, and it wouldn't really be a source of power for them. And so one version of him is he was sort of a somewhat, you might say, a sort of practical Black nationalist leader who really was pro-labor and seeking a path to greater economic power for Black workers. Another account, another way to look at him, was that he was really just a sort of a shill for white employers, and he was recruiting African Americans on their behalf to largely undercut unions, so they might the workers he plays might be strike breakers or something like that, and that his segregated Black unions were really just going to be employer dominated company unions that were used to sort of divide and undermine worker solidarity in any particular workplace. And I would say at any point in time you could find people in Houston's Black community who held both of those views. But I would say the prior view that really saw him as a champion of Black labor probably predominated more in the 20s and early 30s. And by the late 30s, increasingly to African Americans, both in Houston and nationally, he was starting to look more like an agent of maintaining the status quo rather than an agent of change. And in many ways, this is also how the workplace constitution has been viewed over time. These two sort of ways of seeing what it would mean to have constitutional rights in the workplace. On the one hand, it could be something that that really facilitated African-American workers joining the labor movement by getting them access to jobs and getting them access to unions so they could be, as Charles Hamilton Houston, another of the people I write about, said, part of the collective as well as part of the bargain. Or the workplace constitution was really a sort of individualizing rights-based tool that largely benefited conservative forces and hurt labor. And, throughout the entire history I talk about in the book, you could find people who would give you both those accounts of the workplace constitution. And indeed, I think today, if we talked about the future of the workplace constitution, you would find people who would take both those positions on whether or not a workplace constitution is a good thing for workers. And so Bryce, he really captures that kind of puzzle in his own lifetime. And I think illustrates this kind of puzzle about the workplace constitution that I wanted to spool out across the rest of the book and leave readers with in thinking about today.
Yeah, I mean, Rice is facing, a classic dilemma where, racism has been this poison in American labor history and legal history. And, on the one hand, he's, in the 20s, what he's advocating makes sense. There's this brief period in the 1880s and the 1890s where groups, unions like the AFL are cross-racial, and they're trying to organize all races of workers, and that quickly disappears. And so the idea of all Black unions makes sense. But when we have this sea change with the New Deal era, with the Wagner Act and other laws, unions now have exclusive representation to negotiate for all workers, which is a bad deal for Black America, because these local unions have control. They're federalist, they're organized federally, and they're vehemently racist. So You begin the chapter talk, the first part of the book, talking about Rice going before the House Committee on Labor and talking about challenging the Carmen's election on behalf of the All Black National Railway Federation, and this hurdle he faces in challenging the trying to get the state action doctrine.
So you've touched on some of the major transformations that happen in the New Deal that really shift the ground under people like C.W. Rice. So the passage of the Wagner Act and the Railway Labor Act, which together for the first time ever give workers a legal right to organize and require employers to bargain with a union that can show sufficient support among its workers, really just transforms unions from where they had been, which was organizing a small minority of workplaces, to just massively increasing over the next really up 20 years, to the point where by 1955, one out of three non-agricultural workers is a member of a union. So the 30s are just at the very beginning, thanks to these New Deal laws, of this massive increase in unionization. And along with that goes this question for African Americans of how to really position themselves vis-a-vis this massive growth in union power. Given that historically, while there had been moments where it seemed like there might be sort of opportunities for interracial union organizing, the dominant history had been circa 1930, one in which unions were almost exclusively, many unions in their constitutions were white only, and weren't just sort of formally white only, actually used their power to exclude African Americans from whatever type of work they controlled. African Americans sometimes were used as strikebreakers. So there had been this long period of tension and hostility between the labor movement, the organized labor movement, and African Americans. And to the extent African Americans wanted to unionize, they tended to do it in these independent Black unions. So with the New Deal labor laws on the books, they faced a number of choices. One was, one approach that some people like A. Philip Randolph, who was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, a mostly African-American union on the railroads, his approach was to say, look, the way African-Americans have to win equality in the workplace and and from unions is from within. And so he actually affiliated his union with the AFL and sought to win equality from within the labor movement. Another approach was C.W. Rice's, which was to focus on separate unions and to try to maintain African American unions, independent Black unions. Though, as you point out, that becomes increasingly difficult as the new labor laws say, look, you can only have one union per workplace. And so unless you have an all Black workplace, you're also not going to be able to succeed in winning an all Black union. Right. So there's these two sort of organizational strategy choices. And then there's a question of what role the law should have in these efforts. And this is where, the labor leaders, A. Philip Randolph versus C.W. Rice, have different views on this question. The lawyers also have different views on this question. And so some lawyers think, for instance, John P. Davis, who I talk about, who led an organization called the National Negro Congress in the 30s. Some think that, similar to A. Philip Randolph, that the way to the way to win equality is for African Americans to join the more left-leaning and racially progressive unions that begin to crop up in the late 30s, most affiliated with the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which sort of splits off from the AFL and really is trying to have a new sort of more progressive approach to labor organizing. So Davis thinks, you know, we shouldn't turn to the state and we shouldn't turn to law. We should really show, we should win equality by showing our white brothers, what working class brothers, that we stand with them, would be his approach. Other lawyers like Charles Hamilton Houston, who I talked about just a little while ago, believed that there was a room, there was a space for law, that that there was a space to use law to crack open union voice and union union membership for African Americans. And so, in the late 30s, one of the things that happens is there's sort of these internal debates in the bar, but people like Charles Hamilton Houston start to attract Black worker clients, some of them, many of them members of these formerly all Black independent unions, who are trying to figure out how to survive once a white union has won the election and now is the only union that can really represent them. And Houston finds his way to the Constitution as a way to do this. And he manages, he brings a number of cases, he loses in the lower courts, he faces a lot of hurdles, but he finally in 1944 makes it all the way to the Supreme Court with a couple different cases that he's been bringing, and gets the court to sort of, the court stops just shy of saying the Constitution requires unions to be non-discriminatory on the basis of race in terms of membership and representation. Instead, the court says, well, there would be a lot of constitutional problems if the law let unions be racially discriminatory. So we're going to say that we understand the labor law, the relevant labor laws, that Wagner Act, the Railway Labor Act, to sort of, even though they say nothing about it, and even though Congress, when they passed them, was asked to put non-discrimination provisions in and refused, we're going to still interpret these laws to require the unions that represent workers, that are now have this exclusive representative status. So they're the only union that can represent the workers, and they're going to represent all the workers in the workplace. That's going to require them to wield that power fairly. And that means that they can't do things like the railroad unions had been doing, which was win exclusive representative status and then basically kick all the African-American workers off the railroads. So the Supreme Court says, you can't, once you're representative, you have to represent fairly in 1944. The court stops short of saying you have to actually allow African Americans into membership. You don't. So the court says you don't have to let them be members. You don't have to give them a voice in the union or, you know, a sort of a say in union policy. But when you get down to negotiating contracts, you cannot negotiate contracts that are going to basically, you know, get rid of, you know, all the African American workers in a particular job. So that's a major win. It stops short of the full constitutional goal that that Houston had set, and stops short of granting membership, which was also part of what Houston and his civil rights allies had had sought. But it was still a pretty major early accomplishment for African Americans trying to find a way to make sure they were part of this new new modern regime in which workplaces, large workplaces, were going to be unionized, and a lot of the new industries were, you know, and therefore the, you know, the most dynamic area for jobs were going to be controlled by unions.
Right. So, I mean, Houston marks this shift. You know, the courts are understand the these railroad cases, the Steele and Tunstall, that Houston brings forward as you know, narrowly circumscribed statutory or fiduciary duties, not the broad, you know, what you call the liberal workplace constitution, right? That Houston is sort of like cleverly repurposed, you know, from anti-New Deal arguments in defense of this new state. But it marks a shift from folks like Rice, who had embraced the liberty of contract doctrine, right, that had been associated with business and used by the Supreme Court to strike down progressive legislation, which is where we get this term, the right to work. So Houston and these folks are arguing that there's a right to work or a sort of duty of fair representation that unions have as state actors, right? So he's trying to win a place for blacks in this new gigantic world of union labor.
Important pivotal moment, I think, for civil rights advocates like Houston, who are actually, they're not opposed to labor. They think that labor is actually, going to be a very important ally for the for African Americans seeking civil rights. They see the power of the sort of mass action model of unions. So they're, unlike someone like Rice, who's very skeptical of the new unions, the CIO unions, very skeptical of the New Deal. These guys are, they're pro New Deal. They are, think that while it's not perfect, there's a lot of good, a lot of good in the sort of growth of these various New Deal programs, and a lot of potential. A lot of potential for a very powerful alliance in the new expanding labor movement. And so the trick for someone like Houston is to find a way to use the Constitution to not seem like it's part of this long history of employers turning to the Constitution to crush unions or to get rid of sort of labor-friendly laws, but actually to sort of try to find a way to use the Constitution in a way that is about empowering and maybe perfecting the New Deal labor regime rather than trying to thwart it. And that is a very sort of deft move that he makes both doctrinally and politically in convincing ultimately even the CIO and its unions that the Constitution and anti-discrimination claims under the Constitution can really be, can really help this sort of new modern New Deal labor regime, in its ultimate goals to make the United States more labor friendly and more labor friendly economy and more labor friendly political structure.
Right. I mean, and labor was leery of what you call a judicially enforced constitution as well, because the courts had this long history of striking down all these pieces of legislation in their favor. Right. So by the end of the 1930s, they're moving away from this old vision of industrial democracy that involves the state to collective bargaining, right, to private contracts as where all progress will be, right? Industrial pluralism is the term that they're using.
Yeah, and so they, it really comes to the point where in the 40s. I mean, so it's interesting. I think it's very important. A lot of the book is about sort of premised on remembering that we tend to talk about these blocks: the civil rights movement, the labor movement, conservatives, as if they are homogenous and unified. And, the book really tries to point out and remind that these were internally contentious coalitions that had very different views of things. And one thing that is important to note was that this idea that there might be constitutional rights that required unions to be non-discriminatory helped sort of became a useful tool in struggles within the labor movement. So between, if you were a CIO union that was more racially progressive, that was interracial, and that was trying to organize, say, in the South, and you faced a traditional AFL union that had a long history of organizing either only white workers, or to the extent they organized black workers, they would be segregated into a separate union, right? for the CIO as an interracial union, the idea that unions had to not couldn't discriminate actually became a useful tool for them in their battles against these traditional AFL unions, because they could now say, well, even, and this happens in chapter two, one of the most racially progressive CIO unions loses an election at a tobacco plant in the South, and they lose it to this traditionally all-white AFL union that had said, well, if the African American, if they win the election, they would segregate the African American workers at the plant into a separate union. The CIO loses that election and then turns around and says, well, but the Constitution won't let you, the federal government, recognize this AFL union as the representative for these workers because it discriminates. And so, so the CIO really, in some ways, embraces the workplace constitution along with allies like Charles Hamilton Houston and folks in the civil rights movement, because it can help the CIO unions in their own battles with more racially exclusive AFL unions. And so it ends up sort of having these very complicated politics within the labor movement as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, at the same time that this is going on, we have, you know, the anti-New Deal forces, the anti-labor forces, they have not disappeared. They are organizing as well, right? Which gets us to Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah, Cecil B. DeMille is a really, you know, one person said, you know, it's too bad you can't have a Cecil B. DeMille for every chapter. Because he's, yes. You know, he's a very colorful guy.
Yeah.
You know, he also was a very wealthy guy and a guy with a lot of power. So some of the, you know, some of his ability to sort of be such a big character came from some of those privileges. But, you know, Cecil B. DeMille is this really, you know, it's an interesting and savvy operator. You know, basically grew up with the movie industry, you know, started out in silent films, and by, you know, the 1940s is one of the most prominent directors and producers in Hollywood, who has a national reputation. He has a very beloved national radio program he does. So he's just an enormous personality, a very public persona at a time when the nation is really, you know, media is changing and the nation's really just starting to have these kinds of big public personas. So he's in some ways sui generis and also just, you know, got an incredible, sort of incredibly effective pulpit for his views. And it turns out that he is a Republican activist associated with the party's more conservative wing in the 30s and 40s. He's a very ardent anti-communist before anti-communism is really sort of a national phenomenon, and he's very anti-union, or at least anti-closed shop unions, which he sort of wavers on that point a little bit. And he's a member of a union himself, because in order to be to host his radio show, he has to be a member of the American Federation of Radio Artists, because they have what's called a closed shop agreement with the studios, which says that the studios can only hire people who are members of their union to be radio artists. So that means the only way DeMille can have his radio show is if he's a member of AFRA, the Radio Artists Union. And the radio artists he's a member of this union because he has to be, that they control access to the show. And they get involved in California in the early 40s. There start to be the very first state right-to-work law campaigns. Now, these should be very familiar to readers or listeners today, because we've been in a moment where these laws have been very much in the headlines. So these are laws like what was recently passed in Wisconsin. They're laws that a state can adopt that says it's going to be illegal in that state for anyone to have to join or support a union in order to keep a job. So these laws essentially would free someone like DeMille from having to be a member of his union in order to have his radio show. Right. And California is one of the first states that sees one of these campaigns in the early 1940s. And DeMille is a big supporter of this right to work law. And DeMille's union is a big opponent of this right to work law. And the union tells DeMille, look, Mr. DeMille, you, like every other member, are going to have to pay $1 to help fund our campaign against this right to work law. And DeMille is outraged. He thinks this is an enormous violation of his constitutional rights, that he should not have to support support a political campaign he opposes. And so he decides to refuse to pay his dollar bill. And when the union does what is quite predictable in this situation, when the union says, okay, you're not going to pay the dollar bill, then we're not going to let you continue your radio show, he takes them to court and insists that this is a violation of his constitutional rights. And so so the third chapter of the book tells the story of DeMille's lawsuit, which, because of the state action doctrine, which I had talked about earlier, he's trying to say the union violated his constitutional rights. You know, the courts, it's easy for courts to say, well, no, the union can't violate your constitutional rights. The union is a private actor, not a state actor. But even beyond that, even beyond the state action doctrine, just the very premise that by having to pay money to a union to support the union's political campaign, somehow DeMille himself is being forced to support that political campaign, just doesn't compute to courts in the 1940s. They just don't think there's anything, even on the merits, to that kind of a First Amendment claim, that kind of a forced speech claim. They say, essentially, Mr. DeMille, you're free to go out and campaign however you want as a private individual. And once you've given that money to the union, it's really the union's money that's paying for the campaign you oppose, not your money. And so this just doesn't make any sense to us. So he really loses in the courts with this lawsuit in the 1940s. But he's not terribly surprised. And because he is such a savvy guy, he sort of decides that the way to win isn't by bringing more lawsuits, but by really changing how people think about the Constitution and think about that claim he was trying to make, that somehow he was being forced to support and say something that he didn't want to say when his union charged him that fee. And so he, along with a number of their big industrialists and conservative activists, forms a foundation, the DeMille Foundation for Political Freedom. And they make a big cause célèbre out of his fight with his union. One of the backers of the foundation buys him an hour on national radio to tell his story to the nation. And he gives speeches around the country. And he uses this platform basically to make his case about the constitutional violation of the way having to join or support a union violates a worker's constitutional rights. He makes that case to the court of public opinion, and is quite successful in that venue. So successful that really by the 1950s, that claim that argument he had made in the 1940s that just didn't compute in the courts starts to compute in the courts, even in the Supreme Court of the United States, and courts begin to think about the idea of workers having to join or support a union in order to keep their job as something that is constitutionally problematic, at least insofar as that support and that financial support of the union is going to go to political speech on behalf of the union.
Right. So, I mean, we have two movements, and which is this is the framework of the book, right? You trace these two movements from the New Deal to the end of the century, that are both arguing for different conceptions of a workplace constitution, right? For different purposes, and with different results. So how does this play out in the post-war era?
So, the way I talk about it in the book is that you have, on the one hand, a civil rights movement along with its labor allies that are that's really fighting for what I call a liberal workplace constitution. Their idea is that the constitution bars unions and employers from discriminating on the basis of race, and so is it can be a tool to open the workplace and open unions to Black workers who want to access decent jobs, but also just want an opportunity to be part of the union collective, to be part of workers' voice in the union and with employers. And then at the same time, you have what I call a conservative workplace constitution, a movement for a conservative workplace constitution. And these folks are really, unlike the folks who are pushing for a liberal workplace constitution, who favor the New Deal, like the New Deal labor regime, they just want to make sure African Americans have their place at the table. The folks who support a conservative workplace constitution come out of, those who are deeply opposed to the New Deal state, who and particularly its labor regime, want to see these laws undone and see the workplace constitution as a tool to that end. By being able to win the right to what they call the right to work without having to join or support a union. And their ultimate goal with this is really to get rid of the kinds of agreements that unions had often entered into that would require all workers to join or support the union that was going to represent them. And DeMille was quite explicit. This was basically about about defunding the labor movement, and so it wouldn't have be able to exercise the kind of political power that it was exercising.
Right.
So you have these two versions of the two movements pursuing these two different versions of the Constitution, pursuing a workplace constitution to two very different ends. They're sort of at a in the legal DNA, though. Even though they are sort of politically opposed and they want to use the workplace constitution to these very different ends, at the level of sort of constitutional DNA, they're connected because both need to first convince courts that the Constitution should apply in the workplace at all, in the traditionally private sector workplace. And that means they have to convince courts that that doctrine, the state action doctrine that I was talking about before, reaches the private sector workplace. And so that first, there's sort of the first hurdle they face is one they share. And this created both opportunities and complications for these movements as they went forward. It created opportunities in that because the very fact that they share a hurdle, if one of them gets over it, it's going to help the other one, essentially. So let's start with the liabilities. For the civil rights activists, this created complications because they were very closely allied with labor, and they didn't want their claims for a liberal workplace constitution to inadvertently hurt the very unions they were trying to get access to. And it would if they made it over the state action hurdle and then the right to work movement was just able to leap along behind them because of that, because of their success. So this sort of unity in the DNA created problems for civil rights activists, but it also created opportunities. It created political leverage. So what started happening in the 1950s, as the right to work movement took off and was having more success, both politically and in the courts, is that some African Americans would sort of use the threat of possibly joining forces with the right to work folks as a way to try to put a little fire, more fire under the seats of labor leaders to do more to address racial discrimination in the labor movement. This similarity in the DNA also created opportunities for the right to work movement, which started out really, a lot of the sort of early laws that were adopted in the South. A lot of the big actors early on in the right to work movement came out of the South and were closely associated with white supremacism. And so by the 1950s, the right to work movement really had a reputation right up there with the John Birch Society of being, you know, being sort of one step away from the Ku Klux Klan. And what they began to discover in the 1950s was they could capitalize, they could sort of make union discrimination, unions racial discrimination, a right to work argument, right? So they started making arguments like, you know, to, you know, Black voters, African-American workers should be for the right to work because we are going to liberate you from these racially discriminatory unions. And in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the right to work movement more systematically and with increasing sophistication made arguments that really aligned the right to work with not white supremacism, but with the civil rights movement itself and African Americans' civil rights. This sort of created these political opportunities for the right to work movement to really to try to temper that ultra right or white supremacist reputation that the movement had gained in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, and they're aided. I mean, at the same time, they're aided by the turn in labor's image, right? Because with the Senate hearings on corruption. Unions, which are, you know, a much huger part of American life than I think most Americans would find fathomable today. Unions, there's all these investigations into corruption, mostly with the old sort of AFL unions and just a few of them like the Teamsters, but labor takes a hit too. And so there's this transformation on both sides, right?
Yeah, I mean, so the labor movement really reached its peak of sort of density and strength in the mid 50s, and really, you know, is I would say you know the claims of you know is sort of in retrospect I think starts being more on the defensive in the 50s and 60s than maybe even people fully recognized at the time. And, you know, the claims of union racketeering and corruption, that had been sort of a staple of the anti-New Deal, anti-union, right-to-work activists dating back really to the late 1930s. But just as people like Cecil B. DeMille and the right-to-work movement had really sort of started to get courts to see the constitutional right to work constitutional claims from his perspective. Similarly, that movement had really quite effectively started to shift the public perception of unions and really got traction with these claims of you know of racketeering in the labor movement, which and corruption and you know it. These hearings, when all was said and done, did unveil some really bad practices, but they were in particular, you know, tend to be in very particular unions, like the Teamsters, which the AFL then, you know, kicked out. But really the labor movement is going through, you know, is really in some ways on the defensive in terms of its image by the late 1950s and into the 1960s, which, you know, in some ways, you know, made that those sort of tactical moves that the civil rights movement had available to it in some ways more more effective because labor was on the defensive and so it was more sensitive to claims that it wasn't not doing enough on discrimination. but also made, I think, civil rights advocates more leery of workplace constitutional claims because they recognized in some ways more acutely the threat that they could pose to labor and really at the bottom, you know, at bottom, we're trying to win access to labor rather than, you know, doing anything gravely to hurt it. So this was sort of how the stage was set when we get to the 1960s. And the 1960s were a period when, on the one hand, the NAACP starts really taking labor to task more explicitly for and aggressively for the persistent discrimination in a number of its unions. It's also when the labor movement, I think in some ways, the national leaders see, you know, they're sort of trying to herd cats. When you're talking to the level of the national labor leaders, in terms of what's going on at the local level where a lot of this discrimination is occurring in unions, I think they at that point come to see, you know, it would really, you know, they've been supporting a federal law to bar racial discrimination in workplaces since the late 1940s. They really go gangbusters in the 60s. There's this opening, I think, this with the civil rights movement really putting pressure from the grassroots. There's an opening in Congress for something that everyone had thought was totally inconceivable, really even in 1960 when President Kennedy was elected. There is this opening in the, you know, in 1963, 1964. And labor is a big part of what got the Civil Rights Act of 1964, you know, through the congressional sausage making factory and really out the door and into law. And so in some ways, the passage of the Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which for the first time declares for most larger workplaces in the country, that discrimination on the basis of race, sex, national origin, religion is going to be illegal. In some ways, you know, I think most people would expect that this would put an end to the liberal workplace constitution. Right now, you've got a statute, you can bring your claims under that statute, and you don't have to mess with this, you know, it's a politically volatile issue of the workplace constitution to address these issues of racial discrimination in workplaces and unions. And one of the things that's was surprising to me in the history is how much that doesn't end up being the case. It doesn't actually lead to the end of the workplace constitution, but it does mean that the workplace constitution, the liberal workplace constitution, really migrates into administrative agencies. And so you get, during this time, a really big push in the NL, before the National Labor Relations Board to have more robust anti-discrimination policies in the way that it applies to employers and to unions. You get a huge push before the Federal Communications Commission for it to require better anti-discrimination, workplace anti-discrimination measures from the broadcasters and telephone companies that it's regulating. You really get a push in the late 60s and early 70s by civil rights advocates in front of pretty much every major regulatory agency that they adopt rules and regulations that will require equal employment among the entities that they regulate. So even something like the Securities Exchange Commission sees, you know, efforts like this. So it's really kind of surprising, and it's interesting to think why. And part of the reason is that, you know, today Title VII really dominates the field of anti-discrimination law, but it's hard to remember that when it was passed, as much as it was a monumental achievement, there were a lot of ways in which it didn't really do everything that civil rights advocates had hoped, and there were a lot of concerns about limits in the law. It was the agency tasked with implementing it was small, underfunded, very weak, and in the early years, you know, nobody knew that the courts would ultimately enforce it so robustly. So really for a good 10 years after Title VII was passed, I think civil rights advocates were not putting all their eggs in that basket yet. They were really wanting to try to continue to pursue many methods to create pressure on the federal government to create anti-discrimination law. And it turned out that the liberal workplace constitution was a very effective way to do that in front of these administrative agencies.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that chapter on the FCC and the gains that were made by the civil rights movement in the 70s in that area. It reminded me, how important that was to the way that Americans saw the civil rights movement generally as they're going through and having it brought to them by an all-white media, basically. But this gets us back to how this can be sometimes confusing because you write that there's no indication that Republicans were consciously using the Constitution as a Trojan horse for the right to work agenda, but the strongest members on the NLRB are Republicans. There are these free market advocates out there who are still attacking the workplace Constitution, but then there are these conservatives who are pushing for it as well, right?
Yeah. So it has a very, the history of the workplace constitution, the liberal version of it, the version that is, trying to ensure African-American access to unions and to employers. And really by the 60s and 70s, we're also talking about women. They become part of who's going to benefit from this workplace constitution. The internal dynamics on these agencies end up being very politically confounding. So that on the NLRB, for instance, it tends to be the Democratic members who are opposed to the agency adopting more robust anti-discrimination laws and essentially ultimately say, like, maybe we should just leave this to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission charged with implementing it and not get into this stuff ourselves. And the strongest proponents of strengthening these laws are Republicans. Now, on the NLRB, we have to remember there is a tradition of liberal republicanism that's still alive in this era. And at the NLRB, one of the sort of the strongest voice for these policies is a man called Howard Jenkins Jr., who is a son of union members. He's from Denver, Colorado. His dad was in the Postal Workers Union. He's African American. He ends up teaching law at Howard Law School and being involved in a lot of the war rooms that the NAACP would have in the 1950s with their big civil rights cases before they go to the Supreme Court. They, bring in all the great legal minds to moot the arguments and things like that. So he's, very much a part of the civil rights movement. He comes from a labor-friendly tradition, but he's also a Republican from an era in which most African Americans were Republicans because Democrats were associated with Southern Democrats and were seen as, the party of white supremacy. And so someone like Jenkins, I think he certainly has political supporters who are sort of free enterprise, right to work folks. But I think he's really coming at this issue from a deep belief in civil rights and out of that Republican tradition that sort of saw itself as the party of Lincoln. And I think the other, really his closest ally, Republican ally on the board is similar. He's sort of a moderate management side lawyer. He's not one of these far right, really anti-union activists, but he is also a Republican. So yes, I think the number of the Republican supporters on these various agencies, I think, come out either from the sort of civil rights, an older African American civil rights tradition of Republicanism, or sort of the more moderate and liberal wings of the Republican Party. But then you do have people like the at the FCC under Nixon. the chair of the FCC, is really, he's a, you know, a Barry Goldwater protege.
Right,
he comes out of the, you know, the sort of the Sun Belt and, you know, hard right, conservative, free enterprise, you know, kind of right to work advocate community. And with him, I think there you start to see this tinge of right to work activists who see anti-discrimination as being an anti-union tool. So in the opinions he writes for, or the regulations he writes for the FCC, he specifically notes the history of union discrimination and really sort of attributes discrimination to unions rather than to employers, and sort of uses these equal opportunity regulations, equal employment opportunity regulations, as a way to sort of make anti-union arguments at the same time. So I don't think all the Republicans who favor these were, you know, really just shills for the right to work movement, but certainly some of them were and saw this as a nice political opportunity.
Right. And you end the book by talking about how the right divides over this question.
Yes. So the right to work movement, as I said, you know, DeMille really starts to get, you know, his movement has really changed how courts think about this question. And the right to work movement racks up a number of court victories over the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So first, they get the Supreme Court to, in many ways, like civil rights advocates first win before the Supreme Court, to sort of say, well, it would raise a lot of constitutional problems if the labor laws let unions take, you know, require the workers they represent to support their political speech. So we're just going to interpret the Railway Labor Act, you know, not to do that. So we're going to interpret the Railway Labor Act to say, if workers want to withhold their dues from unions' political speech, they have a right to do that. So that's their first win. In the 1970s, the Supreme Court they bring a case that involves public sector workers. So this is a group of teachers, really, actually 5% of the teachers in Detroit sign on to this case. But it involves a public sector union. So there's not the state action problem. And so there the court reaches the constitutional question head on and says, you know, under the Constitution, any person represented by a union has a right to opt out of the union's political speech if they want to. And so that's a huge win for the right to work movement. And then in the 1980s, you know, if you think about it, right, the wins in the 1960s were under, you know, Kennedy was president, and the big win in the 1960s, you know, when they win in the 1970s, it's under the tail end of the Ford administration, I think. But Carter's coming in, and so in terms of the sort of overall politics, you know, it's not like this is the most favorable time for a conservative movement. By the time the 1980s comes, Ronald Reagan has, you know, won the White House, and, you know, there's sort of a sense that this is a sort of a moment of political opening and power for the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and the right to work movement expected to sort of ride on the coattails of this movement that they saw themselves as helping to this political power they saw themselves as helping to achieve. And so they bring what is really sort of their biggest and most important case, which is a case to try to challenge the union security agreements, these agreements that say workers have to join or support a union to keep their job. In the vast majority of workplaces that are organized under the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, the New Deal labor law that was passed in 1935. So they've gotten it under the Railway Labor Act, but that just deals with the railroads and airlines. They've gotten it for public sector workers, but that only works for people working for the government. So this is really going to be their opportunity to make the national, make the right to work really a national rule. And they bring a lawsuit on behalf of Harry Beck, a communications, a telephone worker from Maryland, and a small group of other of his coworkers, and they get tremendous success in the lower courts. They win in the district court, which finds, you know, again, getting back to the state action question, reaches the constitutional point head on and says the union violates these workers' First Amendment rights if it requires them to contribute to the union's political speech. So they win that in the district court in 1981. They go up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, they win again, including a Court of Appeals opinion endorsing that that this is really a constitutional violation. It's not just something wrong under the statute, and they go from there to the Supreme Court, and it's sort of Reagan is now in his second term. He's really not only set out a conservative Republican political agenda, but also a conservative Republican constitutional agenda. His attorney general, Ed Meese, is sparking huge controversies by giving speeches in support of originalism, this sort of conservative, a new conservative at that time idea about how the Constitution should be interpreted. Meese is laying out an agenda for the federal government lawyers on, you know, all the positions they should be taking on the Constitution. So, on the face of it, this seems like a very auspicious time. And Reagan has also appointed a number of new Supreme Court justices to the court. So there, you know, there's sort of a sense that this is this great moment of opportunity. And yet, when the right to work folks take Beck's case to the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General, who's sort of the lawyer for the government, comes out against them, says that, first of all, there's no state action here, so they have no constitutional claim. And second of all, these are private actors. This is a private union and a private employer, and they should be free to make whatever kinds of agreements they want, including ones that require workers to support the political speech of unions. This is, you know, the good conservative position is one that respects these private actors' freedom of contract. And so he actually files a brief with the Supreme Court rejecting the right to work Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation's arguments top to bottom. And this sparked an enormous internal debate within the White House and the Department of Justice over what the government's position should be on these. They get a lot of flack from supporters. The headlines in the newspapers read things like, you know, can you believe basically that the Reagan administration is union's best friend? I'm paraphrasing right here, but, you know, these are shocking, shocking headlines. And then the Supreme Court gets its hands on it. And interestingly, the Supreme Court ultimately finds in an opinion written by the same justice who wrote the opinion back in 1961 on behalf of the railroad workers, just as he had found that the Railway Labor Act actually just on its own required workers to have this right to opt out of political speech, he finds, this is Justice Brennan, he interprets the National Labor Relations Act also to implicitly provide this right to workers that they opt out of political speech. And so he's able to avoid the constitutional questions, but basically gives now the right to work movement. They've had their win for railroad workers. They've had their win for public sector workers. And now they've established that same legal principle for the vast majority of workers who are governed by the National Labor Relations Act. So an enormous win for the right to work movement. Interestingly, the three justices that dissented were all Republican appointees, two of them Reagan appointees, and they basically agreed with the Solicitor General. So I sort of end the book with this moment where you see that just as the liberal workplace constitution became this very kind of polarizing and splitting issue in the New Deal coalition, similarly, the conservative workplace constitution ends up being this very very sort of divisive and politically polarizing element in the new right, and particularly a new right that, again, we tend to think of as sort of hegemonic in a way that overlooks these kind of internal fissures.
Yeah. So where are we now? You know in the epilogue that state action doctrine has sort of fallen away.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting, so I've known this from, I teach employment law at the law school, and I always teach these studies that that several legal scholars have done that show that that workers vastly misperceive the extent of legal protections in the workplace. Most workers don't realize that they can, unless they're covered by a union contract or they work for the government and are a member of the civil service, they can be fired for any reason or no reason at all. It's called the at-will doctrine, and that's the general default rule. If you have a job and you don't have a contract that specifically says otherwise, that's your state. You can be fired for any reason or no reason at all. So I knew that generally workers really overestimate their degree of protections. Most of them think that that's not the case, that their employer has to have a good reason to fire them. But I was curious what people thought, particularly about whether they had constitutional rights in the workplace. And so I actually worked with a psychology PhD student, and we created a survey and surveyed people about their perception of their constitutional rights at work. And turns out, quite similar to the findings about legal protections generally, most people thought that they had constitutional rights at work. And to the extent that they did think they had a constitutional right at work, they didn't think it mattered whether who they worked for was Bank of America or the city of Philadelphia. So they had no sense of the state action doctrine and how crucial it is in terms of limiting constitutional rights. So start with the fact that most people today, I think they have a lot of constitutional rights in the workplace that they don't have. So where are we today? I wanted the book both to act as a corrective to that, to help people understand that they don't have constitutional rights at work, but also to help them understand why, where that has come from. And because I think you can't really understand whether you think that's a good or a bad thing that you don't have those constitutional rights at work unless you understand this history. So where are we today? Today, workers, unless you work for you work for a public employer, you don't have constitutional rights at work. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not sure it's a bad thing. I think it might be I think the history might suggest that there are a lot of constitutional values that and sort of kinds of protections workers might want in the workplace, but you might want to get them via a statute like the Civil Rights Act rather than via the Constitution itself. But I think that there are good reasons to think that speech rights, privacy rights, due process rights are things that workers would want today, whether they want to win those under the Constitution or through their legislatures or through unions. I think that's a separate question.
Yeah. Well, I just find this all fascinating. I'm so glad you wrote this book. I hope everyone reads it. Thanks for joining us. There's a traditional question here that we're asked to give our authors, and that's, what are you working on something right now? What is that?
Yeah, well, so, I will say, and I've talked to a number of other people about this, this was my first book. So now, this is done. I'm turning to the next one. And it's a really interesting process to, when you start a book as a graduate student, to sort of figure out how you start a second book as a no longer a graduate student. So I'm at the very beginning stages of the next project. And I can't tell you in too much detail what it's going to be because I don't know yet. But the general... Right. The general scope of it is looking at the history of privacy and the Constitution and how we came to value privacy as a sort of an aspect of constitutional rights.
Okay, sounds good. Sophia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great, thank you so much.
All right, talk to you.
Okay.
Bye.